Let's call this meeting of the Senate Judiciary Committee to order. It is 2:29 p.m. on Wednesday, February 21st, 2024. Before we begin, I want to thank Juliana Singh, Senate Judiciary Secretary, who makes sure we have a transcript of our meetings, and Dylan Williams from the Juno LIO, who makes sure we have sound. This time, I want to remind committee members and those in the room to please silence your cell phones. Present today, we only have one member of the committee. That would be me, the committee chair. While we do not have a quorum to do legislative business, we are not taking action today on legislation, so we can proceed with our meeting. Our first and only order of business today is a presentation from the Alaska Children's Justice Act Task Force. Here to present is Josh Lewaerts and Kathy Baldwin-Johnson. You already have come forward. Please identify yourselves for the record, and you can begin your presentation.
For the record, my name is Josh Lowers. I am the Director of Statewide Initiatives at Covenant House Alaska and the current chair of Alaska's Children's Justice Act Task Force, and I'm based in Anchorage.
For the record, I'm Kathy Baldwin-Johnson. I'm the Medical Director for the Children's Place and Alaska Cares, two of the Child Advocacy Centers in South Central Alaska. I am one of the medical representatives on the Alaska Children's Justice Act Task Force, and I'm from the beautiful Mat-Su.
All right. Thank you for having us here, Senator. So today we want to share about how young people or how children are being served in Alaska when it comes to maltreatment response. So we're going to talk a little bit about what we do and what we are, and a brief overview of ACEs, but more specifically about what's ACEs that are affecting young people in Anchorage or in Alaska, talk about child abuse and neglect in Alaska, and then some recommendations. The task force is a federally mandated and funded task force, began in 2000. So we've had an Alaska Children's Justice Act task force for 24 years, and it is our job to be a multiple disciplinary group from all around the state to improve our systems, to advocate for legislation change, and to educate on the current state of young people moving through our child maltreatment systems.
Right. So I'm going to I think probably you're very aware of adverse childhood experiences in the study. So this is just a very quick Reader's Digest condensed version of that. A reminder that the first adverse childhood experiences study came out of Southern California through the Centers for Disease Control and Health Maintenance Organization Kaiser Permanente. And what they did was ask over 17,000 adults who were enrollees at Kaiser about things that happened to them when they were children. So they asked about different types of abuse and neglect, as well as five different categories of household dysfunction. And then the ACE scores that were given had to do with the different categories of these different kinds of abuse and neglect and household dysfunction that these adults had experienced as children. The majority were white, they were middle-aged, and the majority of them had had some college, and either they or their spouses had employments, which is why they had Kaiser's, their health insurance plan. So one of the things...
Senator Tobin joined us about 2:32. Please proceed.
Thank you. So one of the things that they found that was surprising in what we would consider a relatively low-risk population was how common these adverse childhood experiences were for these folks. And the other thing that they found is that it had rarely been one just bad thing that had happened to these adults when they were children. So there was an 87% chance that they had experienced at least one other category of either abuse, neglect, or household dysfunction. And there was a 50% chance that they had experienced at least three of these categories. And then what they were able to do, because this was a health maintenance organization, is that they were able to look at what the health and well-being of these adults was now and compare that to what had happened to them when they were children. And they found links with all of the most common causes of morbidity and mortality that we see in our country today, as well as a whole host of social ills. And as further research has been done, not only has this research shown that it wasn't just in Southern California that this was true, but there have been research studies done all over the country and in other countries as well. And some of the things that have shown up is that when children do experience traumatic things, it really alters how gene expression occurs, and it affects how brain development occurs, which helps to account with some of these adverse things that we see in adults. Here in Alaska, we're not immune. You guys are probably very well aware that we have traditionally, for years, had one of the highest rates of child maltreatment in the country. And we've had some ACEs studies that have been done here in our state as well that have had very similar findings to that initial study that was done in Southern California, and with very similar outcomes. So people with high ACE scores, so far or greater, are much more likely to be unemployed, unable to work, to live in poverty, to have poor physical health, to have poor mental health. And again, just like in the original ACEs study, it's never just one bad thing for Alaskans as well. There was a study that looked at the economic burden of child maltreatment in our state. And so this was just for 2019. They found that the economic burden was estimated to be $710 million in terms of taking care of the health of children that had been abused, dealing with children that needed to come in to be involved with our child protection system, with OCS, with the criminal justice system, with special education, with lost productivity and things like that. And if we looked at sort of the quality of life issues, like early mortality and quality of life reduction, things like pain and suffering, the estimates were $2.3 billion. And again, this was just for that one year of data. So just to help kind of describe the kind of things that we see with the children and families that we serve, we have just sort of a story to help illustrate this. So we're going to talk about Patricia, who is a 10-year-old little girl who lives with her mother, Alicia, with her stepfather, Jason, and her 6-year-old brother, William. Mom, Alicia, is a nurse who works nights, and stepdad, Jason, is a firefighter. When Patricia was born, she was born prematurely because her biological father, now an ex-husband of her mother, had strangled her mom and had kicked her mom in the stomach, which caused her to go into premature labor. So Patrick ended up being arrested, and Alicia was protective, filed a restraining order, and ended up divorcing Patrick while Alicia was still an infant. So Alicia met Jason the firefighter through her work. He really swept her off her feet. He was eager to adopt Patricia, and so they moved in together into Jason's house when Patricia was 4. And then Alicia had baby boy William shortly after that. So Jason was father to William. When Patricia went to a personal safety presentation at school when she was in 4th grade, some of the things that she heard about made her realize that maybe the things she was experiencing at home were not okay. So she went to her teacher and said something like, "That's been happening to me." And what we find is that disclosures of abuse are really, really common after these personal safety presentations in the schools. So that's certainly been our experience at both of the child advocacy centers that I work with.
Well, welcome, Senator Keel at 238. Please proceed.
Thank you. So Patricia's teacher followed Alaska law, so she made a report to both the Office of Children's Services and to law enforcement because this was an allegation of sexual abuse. The OCS social worker came to do a very brief screening interview of Patricia at the school, found out that mom was not aware of the abuse, and so both OCS and law enforcement worked together with their local child advocacy center to have mom bring Patricia to their CAC for Patricia to be evaluated. And that process, just to explain for people who may not be aware of the process for CACs, is that usually the child and then the parent, the non-offending parent or caregiver, is given a tour. The process is explained to them. Their team is going to include a family advocate from the Child Advocacy Center, an OCS worker, if OCS is involved, a law enforcement officer, if law enforcement is involved, and a medical provider. The team will sit down and meet with Alicia, explain what their concerns are for the child. And in this case, Alicia was not aware of what had been going on, so she was understandably very, very shocked and tearful. And then Patricia ended up having a forensic interview. These forensic interviews are done by somebody who's got special training and expertise in talking to kids about really challenging, hard things, and doing that in a way that's non-leading, so that nothing is being suggested to the child. So Patricia discloses that since she was 6 years old, that her daddy or stepdad was coming into her room at night when mom was working, and he was doing inappropriate things. And it's we talked about this. Kids will use words like inappropriate because they've heard words like that and they understand that. He also was showing her videos of naked people on his phone. And then she also described, because kids get screened for other safety concerns in the home as well, so she also described that daddy was drinking and then he'd yell at and hit mom. Patricia then had a head-to-toe exam with a nurse practitioner who also had specialized training and experience in doing exams for kids with a concern for abuse or neglect. Her exam was normal, which was what we expected, given that what she described about what was happening and the time that it occurred, the last time that the abuse had occurred. So we went ahead and tested a urine for gonorrhea and chlamydia, and were able to reassure Patricia and her mom that her body was okay, which is a really important part of that exam that we do. And then Patricia's brother, 6-year-old William, was also interviewed because he may have been a witness to what had happened, and he may have also been another victim. So often we are interviewing siblings as well. So he didn't disclose any sexual abuse by his dad. He did describe the fact that his sister had come into his room when he was getting dressed one time and asked if she could kiss his pee-pee like she kisses daddy's pee-pee. So he said yes because he's 6 and he was confused. And then he later told his dad, who then hit Patricia with a belt and with what he described as a million times. And then he said Patricia couldn't sit down after that. So often when kids can, for various reasons, develop sort of their own problematic sexual behaviors, and sometimes that is because of the sexual abuse that they have endured themselves. So kind of the next steps when we're doing this multidisciplinary response is that law enforcement will talk about their next steps, so doing whatever they need to do for their investigation, which may mean looking for evidence at the scene, doing court-authorized recordings of conversations, doing other witness interviews, and basically looking for other corroborating evidence. So this case is something that can go forward and be prosecuted. OCS talks about safety planning with the mom and the kind of things that they think that she needs to do to show that she'll be able to keep her children safe going forward. And because they're living in Jason's house, mom was able to say, you know, my parents, the grandparents, they play a really active role in our lives, and they're willing to let us move in with them so we can get out of this house. And mom said she would get a protective order on behalf of her children. And then the family advocate at the Child Advocacy Center was able to work with mom to be able to figure out, okay, what are your strengths and what are your needs so that we can be sure that we can do everything we can to support those strengths that you have as a parent and as a family, and be able to address the kind of needs that you may have, which often in situations like this means getting mental health counseling for everybody in the family, and certainly for the child that's the primary victim. And then over the long haul, OCS does their follow-up. So they would have substantiated against Jason because they believed what this child had to say. And then they closed their case against mom because she had demonstrated her protectiveness for her children and mom had been unaware of any of the things that had been happening. And then in terms of follow-up, this was a case that got referred on to the prosecutor, and a grand jury indicted Jason on multiple counts of sexual abuse of a minor. And he made the decision after consulting with his attorney that he would take a plea deal, so it reduced the number of counts, but because of our pretty good laws that we have in our state, it still meant that he had a prison sentence of 20 years and would be required to register like for a lifetime as a sex offender. And then our advocates at the Child Advocacy Centers, they will stay in touch with mom to make sure that she and her children are continuing to be able to access mental health services and any other resources that they might need. And she'll continue that involvement until the court case is settled and or until mom feels like she and the children are doing well and don't need any further support from the Child Advocacy Center. So this is considering the horrible things that happened to these children. This is a case where we really had as ideal an outcome as we possibly could imagine. So there were a number of protective factors for this family, a number of supports that were available for this family. The reality is for many children in our state, they may not feel safe talking about the things that happened to them. They may not have a safe person that they can go to. They may not have supportive and protective caregivers around them. They have to wait months to be seen by a trained therapist, and they may not have any of these resources available in their home communities. And our agencies that are all these multidisciplinary agencies that are responsible for responding and providing these services are often really understaffed in our state right now. So we do know that because of child advocacy centers, we have this amazing opportunity to reduce future exposure to adverse childhood experiences, to reduce that dose of trauma that children get, and to be able to have more successful resolutions for these cases, to get the kind of services that children and their families really need for healing and for better protection of kids going forward. And what that means downstream, not that it's always all about economics, but we really can, if we can reduce these downstream effects, we really can reduce our state budget, because we know from the research done here in our state that it is really expensive to take care of kids once something has happened to them and they don't get what they need. So then we want to think about, well, what if we could work further upstream with children? And one of the things that's helping us to figure out how far upstream we need to go is an ongoing longitudinal research study that's being done here in Alaska called ALCAN Link. It's the Alaska Longitudinal Child Abuse and Neglect Linkage Project. So this is a population design. It's following a large group of children and seeing kind of based on risk factors that can be identified prenatally based on our PRAMS data, and then following kids and looking using CUBS data when kids are three, and looking at data from OCS and from the court system and things like that, and combining all these data sources. One of the things that they're finding following children over time is that about 1 out of 7 children born in Alaska will have a report made to OCS and law enforcement concerning child sexual abuse before they turn 12. And 1 out of 3 are going to have a report made to OCS for some kind of abuse or neglect. We do know that there are risk factors that we can identify, and intimate partner violence is certainly a huge, huge risk factor. We know that children who are in a home where there's violence, they are more likely to end up having an allegation of harm or an allegation of sexual abuse. So 2.6 times more likely than with moms that don't report intimate partner violence. And we've got really good research in our state looking at the outcomes from when children are exposed to intimate partner violence. They're more likely to struggle in school. They're so much more likely to have a report made to OCS for anything. They're more likely to develop higher ACE scores. And they're more likely to, where it's not just one bad thing. Again, it's not just the intimate partner violence exposure. They're also much more likely to be experiencing a lot of other adversities in their homes and communities. Also, based on this research, what's being found is that if you have a mom that doesn't have very many risk factors and you're able to keep them in that low risk factor category, their chances of a report made to OCS are much, much lower. And likewise, a mom that is at high risk has a lot of these pre-birth household challenges. So mom has already has a high A score. If you can do things to improve risks in that family, you will drop that family's risk of needing further involvement by OCS substantially. Whereas if you take a mom who's at low risk and now you introduce a lot of other things like intimate partner violence, losing their home, their partner going to jail, substance use, any of those kinds of things, you're really going to increase the risk then of OCS having involvement in this family's life. And again, this does that have an impact then on economics in our state. So the question is, could we have helped Alicia sooner? And certainly we have a lot of proven primary prevention programs here in our state that really help families be stronger and better able to nurture and protect their children. And for example, Help Me Grow is one of those. Certainly the earlier reporting of child maltreatment can occur, and the sooner we can have these interventions, the better it's going to be. Again, reducing that dose of ACEs. The more we can have this multidisciplinary response through our child advocacy centers, the more likelihood that families are going to be able to get the resources and help that they need, that children are going to have a voice. The more likely kids are to be able to get treatment and their families to get treatment and to get those services. And if we've got laws that are effective at holding offenders accountable, then we're able to reduce the number of future victims that offenders have. We've got science that shows we know the kind of things that help strengthen families and help protect kids from harm and future harm. And so the focus is on adults. So it's not asking children to protect themselves from their abuse. It's asking adults to kind of band together and support each other and to keep an eye out for kids. So having caring adults outside the home, making sure kids get those concrete neat things that they need, like food and shelter. Those are all things that we could do to help ensure that kids are going to be safer and that their families can provide that role of keeping them safer.
So as we stated before, part of our mission is to help improve our current system of child maltreatment response. And as we've been gathered here this week, meeting together and hearing updates from folks around the state and in multiple disciplines, the biggest concern that was brought forward was our shortage of professionals in our state across the board. And I know that's not a surprise to anybody. As we recognize that there is a workforce shortage across the country. However, when we were asking our members, what brought them to Alaska or what kept them in Alaska to be public servants, things that came up, and I say this noting that the task force does not have an opinion on how we might incentivize folks to stay here, but things that have helped folks on our task force who have been lifelong public servants have been the pension and been the loan forgiveness and been the high wages that were around, earlier in our statehood. And so as I said, we don't have an opinion about how we incentivize folks to get here, but we do have a strong sense that if we can improve systems, we can improve legislation. If we don't have the people to do it, we're not going to be supporting our families and our children. That's just something that we really, all of us would love to figure that out here in our state. We did send along, so as I said, one of the things that we do is we advocate for potential legislative changes. And so I did send along with the packet to Brianna four separate potential bills that we've worked on, and knowing that at this point in session, folks aren't necessarily putting bills forward, but just wanted to send those to you all. And those are focused on the MDT statute, to better help CACs be able to help folks experiencing problematic sexual behaviors. We are advocating for an expansion of mandatory reporters and more folks who are trained to understand what they're looking at. And then we have some proposed statutory changes to deter unreasonable corporal punishment in children. So please take a look at those if you have questions, or we'd love to answer those. And then
we'll distribute those cool legislative packets to members of the committee, awesome, including those that aren't here today.
Thank you.
And then we've been looking for champions, and we want to say a big thank you through the chair to Senator Tobin and Senator Giesel and the folks from the House that are launching the Alaska Children's Caucus again tomorrow evening. We're very excited to be working with you and to be part of a collective of providers and legislators to better support families and better support children in our state. So thank you. And then we think about hope. You know, we look through all this data, and you know, actually, there's been many times already this meeting around the table where we get to a moment of, everything's broken, it seems like. But we know that young people who experience ACEs, if they have hope, if they have systems that support them, if they have people that support them, if they have ability to see the other side, they can overcome those ACEs. And they can be, you know, happy and functioning members of society. And, you know, and not only do they then contribute, but then they're not part of that group that we are spending a lot of money to take care of. So thank you for the opportunity to be here today. We're happy to answer any questions. And we look forward to continuing to be able to work with you going forward.
Senator Tobin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I apologize for being tardy. I was actually presenting to the Alaska Municipal League, and I find that intriguing, as your second to last slide has a quote that is one I used during my presentation, which is from Frederick Douglass, which is, "It's easier to build strong children than repair broken men." And I think about this quite a bit, particularly in the education space. And so I appreciate slide number 14, where you talk about personal safety and that instruction in school, that knowledge that may not be provided to a child in their family where abuse is happening, but it comes from a trusted adult, mm-hmm, and how critical our public schools are to ensuring that our young kids know that some of the things that are happening to them are not okay. It also makes me really proud to have worked on the Alaska Reads Act, where we did expand that mandatory reporting to anyone who receives ADM funding for pre-K expansion, because we know in those very early years, those trusted adults will hear many things, and we want to make sure that they are required to report. So I look forward to tomorrow's first initial caucus meeting of the Children's Caucus and having some conversation about some of the legislation that you've proposed and ways that we can move forward together.
Thank you very much. I don't see any other questions. So thank you very much for the presentation. It's very informative, and really appreciate your taking the time. We are going to adjourn for the day. We do not have a meeting scheduled for Friday, February 23rd. Our next meeting will be Monday, February 26th, 1:30 p.m. We will stand adjourned. The time is now 2:58 p.m.